and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. And as always, we're glad to have you drop by and participate in the discussion. You may recall that 2 weeks ago we heard Dr. Mark Forman explain why abortion was wrong from a natural law Aristotelian perspective. This week, Dr. Forman's going to help us think more deeply about a wide array of different bioethical issues, including everything from transhumanism to position assisted suicide. Dr. Forman is a professional philosopher who specializes in bioethics, so you might want to buckle up because he's going to move very quickly through these different topics. Before we get to the conversation with Dr. Forman, I just want to quickly explain what it means to be a natural law theorist. Natural law theory is a theory of the right. It gives an explanation of what makes some action right or wrong, in the same way that divine command theory gives an explanation of what makes something right or wrong. On divine command theory, something is right to do if God commands it. And on natural law theory, right and wrong actions are determined by a thing's nature. If, for example, humans are rational creatures, then we ought to always treat them as ends and never merely as means, as Kant might say. It's also worth noting here that natural law theory and divine command theory are not at odds. Dr. Forman is both a natural law theorist and a divine commands theorist, as are many other Christian ethicists. One advantage that natural law theory gives is that it allows us to enter into a discussion about ethics with a person who doesn't necessarily believe in God. To have the conversation, the person just needs to agree with us that humans are rational creatures, and that this makes certain actions right or wrong. If humans have an essential nature, and that is being a rational creature, then perhaps it's wrong to kill them without a good reason. Now, Christian natural law theorists absolutely do think that God is necessary for morality, and that there are a number of reasons for this. Just briefly, one might be that you might think that it's simply impossible to have any rational creatures unless you have God as their creator. Or you might think that there can be no such thing as enduring natures on a purely physical, material view of the universe. And in terms of apologetics, natural law theory might help us find common ground with atheists and other theistic skeptics. We can agree that humans are essentially a certain way and that they ought to act in this or that way because of that. If our convictions about human nature and right actions are shored up, we can then ask the question, what best explains this story about human nature and right action? Does it make more sense to think that God made humans in his image and that this confers upon them certain rights and dignity? Or does it make more sense to think that rights and dignity just appear on the scene when we get sophisticated enough biology and chemistry? With this in mind, we'll head over to the Jerry Falwell Library and hear what Dr. Forman has to say about Christianity and bioethics. I'm here again with Dr. Mark Forman, who we heard from earlier, he said his specialty was bioethics, so I couldn't miss the chance to ask him some questions about that and maybe how that applies to morality and Christian ethics in particular. So maybe you could just start off and say bioethics. Some people might not be sure what that term actually means.
Sure. Biomedical ethics basically looks at conflicts that occur between the relationship of the medical sciences and medical research and medical progress, okay, and the rights and values of human beings, okay. In other words, we recognize that medicine is a good. Everybody agrees with that. Nobody's going to deny that. And it's good to have medical progress, and it's good to have medical research. Those are very good things, okay. We also recognize that human beings have value and that human beings have rights, and we should honor those rights, and we should honor the value of human beings. But the problem is oftentimes these two good things come into conflict. And when they come to conflict, we have to find a way of resolving that conflict. Okay? So let's take an example here. Let's say we have an elderly gentleman, okay, who is suffering terribly from a disease and we're wondering now, you know, wouldn't the best way to maybe end his suffering would just simply be to end his life. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there's a good we want to achieve. We want to end his suffering, okay? And we can do that. We have medicine that will allow us to do that. But of course, that's going to have the bad effect of also hastening his death, bringing about death quicker than death would actually occur naturally, okay? In a sense, we're going to kill him to end his suffering, okay? Mm-hmm. Ending the suffering is a good, but the killing is not, okay? We don't want to do that. So we have the medical ability to do that. So they've come to conflict. how do we resolve that conflict? What do we do when we have that? Right. Or take the idea of abortion, for example, okay? Abortion, we have the life of the unborn. We have a mother who doesn't, for some reason, want to have the unborn. Let's say the mother, you know, to have a child would be extremely difficult for her to have a child. She has the right to privacy, what to choose to do with her own body, which we certainly recognize we all have the right to do, the right to choose what to do with our body. But there's also the right to the life of the child. These two good things have come into conflict. How do we handle that? So a lot of times people think that bioethics is about a good thing versus a bad thing. It's usually about two good things that have simply come into conflict. And now we have to, in some way or another, resolve the conflict to figure out what it had to happen. Bioethics is a fairly recent field. It's only been around for about 30 to 40 years. The reason being is that technology has simply gotten to such a level that it's created these ethical dilemmas that we just never had before. You know, people are living longer, and because they're living longer, they're dying from long, drawn-out, degenerative types of diseases, okay, that have become very costly, very expensive for these people to be able, for many people to be able to pay and be able to live by. They, in a sense, the question has become, Are we allowing people to live longer, or are we just simply allowing them to take a longer time to die? Right. Okay, and so there's a question concerning that. There's questions concerning what does it mean for a person to begin? What does it mean? When does life actually begin? We now have the ability to end life in the womb in a way that we never had before. That could be extremely easy and convenient. You know, should we be using that or not? Is this a human being or not? So it's raised a lot of the philosophical arguments, you know, that bioethics has come in and tried to basically help us to think through and resolve. And so that's really what bioethics is about. It's just making these ethical decisions concerning the biological processes of medicine and its progress and its research.
No, I think that as a natural law of virtue ethics person, this actually might give you an advantage over some other kind of ethical theories in this, because you have access to kind of more resources to work with this. So, like, you know, you can think about with the euthanasia, for example, you know, you could think about what's human nature and what counts as human flourishing, and then that can give you some resources. And then go to scripture too to see what human flourishing consists of.
Yeah, very much so. And as a Christian bioethicist, right, one whose you know, ethical thinking is going to be very much shaped by my faith, by scripture, by my Christian tradition, and things like that, I'm going to have some resources that I'm going to use that the non-Christian, for example, isn't going to use. You know, so he's going to have to appeal to something else. Maybe just his view of humans, or his mm-hmm. values of humans, or the idea of promoting happiness or something like that will become. And many bioethicists are utilitarians. You know, they'll say, well, what's going to promote the greatest amount of happiness situation? You know.
So let me ask you, this is something that I've been thinking about, and I've been wanting to talk to bioethicists about is, the issue of transhumanism. I don't know have you thought about that any at all?
I'm not sure what you mean by the term. You can explain it a little bit.
Well, I mean, so technology now has the capacity to augment humans biologically in ways that I think could potentially compromise their integrity as humans, right? So you might even think of this as, you know, you could get an implant in your eye or something that could cause you to see all different spectrums of light, or you could get a processor implanted in your brain that might increase the number of neurons that fire, so you could think faster than other people. I wonder what you think about as a Christian ethicist, like that kind of technology.
Yeah, it's a very good question, yeah. And it's not easy to always draw the hard and fast lines with some of this stuff. We get into some gray areas a little bit here where we all kind of, the thinking gets a little fuzzy here. So let me give some general things.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, in general, I think we need to recognize our limitations, what we can be, what we can and should be as human beings. You know, not everything that can be done necessarily means it should be done. And that we need to be guided by the limits that we are as humans. We're human beings. We're not gods. And so any action which enhances, which goes towards human enhancement, I think we need to be very, very cautious about, okay, trying to live beyond the limits of what we're supposed to be as human beings. So you sometimes have to make a distinction between therapeutic purposes and enhancement purposes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I have a particular, a procedure that's going to, in some way or another, deal therapeutically with a human being, and therapeutically meaning helping them to deal with a specific disease that's causing them not to function as human beings are supposed to function, you know, then that's not necessarily going to be problematic, not as problematic, okay? But if I have a particular medical procedure that's going to enhance that person to make them in some way or another a better human being, now we need to slow down and we need to think about it for a second, because we start doing that kind of stuff, then we start creating different kinds of races, and we start getting into the issue of, you know, what does it mean to be human, you know, and the possibility of future discrimination, the possibility of all sorts of things come into play there that I think we need to slow down and think very seriously about. You know, I'm not going to say 100% that we should never do any of this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm just simply going to say that caution really needs to be taken about what, why, and where we're doing the things that we are doing here. I am very leery of that kind of stuff, but I don't want to be so leery that I'm not open to at least hearing things. You know, yeah. I think sometimes some Christians, you know, they kind of give the impression that, well, every time you do something like that, you're quote unquote playing God. Well, the playing God argument is a really tough card to draw, because the problem is anytime that you're medically doing a procedure, in a sense, you're playing God. Okay. A person comes into the emergency room, they were in a car accident, you know, and you go in to save their life. Well, you're playing God at that point. Maybe God wants them to die at that particular point. You're going to play God and keep them alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could give that kind of an argument, which I think would be a silly argument. Okay. So I'm hesitant to use that. I would say the one place though where I am more willing to use the playing God card is when it comes to some sort of genetic manipulation that's going to cause changes down the road in the future. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cause that's where we don't have a God's eye perspective. We just simply don't know what's going to happen. So for example, what we call germline therapy. Germline therapy is basically therapy where we do genetic research on your reproductive cells. So you're going to pass this on to future generations. That I'm very hesitant about, because we simply don't know until those future generations come about several decades down the road, you know, what the consequences of that therapy is going to be. Okay. We don't have that perspective, that God perspective. So there, in a sense, we are kind of playing God. So that kind of genetic enhancement and such like that, mm-hmm. I think we need to be very careful about. I think we need to stay within the area of therapy and try to avoid the area of enhancement.
Yeah. So maybe you could expand on why that is. Why do you think that is we shouldn't enhance ourselves?
Well, I think part of it to me is just simply recognizing, again, the idea that we're limited. We're not supposed to be, you know, super beings. We're not supposed to be God. God placed upon us certain limitations, and I think that we need to respect the limitations that God's placed upon human beings. Mm-hmm. So that would be my number one area there, is that we just need to recognize the human limitations. But again, I want to be careful here. I don't want to sit here and say that I'm absolutely closed to anything. It depends. I would want to look at each individual example and examine it in and of itself. It's hard to make general claims about this.
Yeah.
You know, it's just very difficult to do so.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you a practical question.
Okay.
Let's say that, I've seen, you know, on the internet, I've seen cases of people doing this kind of thing where they might get a chip implanted in their fingertip or something that has their credit card information or something like that.
Right.
So that, you know, you go to the grocery store, you don't need your wallet or anything, you could just walk in and you just scan your finger across a scanner, and that's how you pay for your groceries.
Right.
So, if an LU student came up to you and asked you, Dr. Foreman, what would you advise me to do in this case? What do you think?
Well, in that particular situation, I don't know if that's necessarily an enhancement of a human being. Sure. I don't think we've actually changed the nature of a human being. We simply have changed the ability to do something by putting it in a particular location where it makes it easier to do that. When I'm talking about enhancing human beings, I'm talking about enhancing their natural inherent abilities to do things. Okay. So for example, you know, my example is something I would be careful about is the example used, for example, of the eye, you know, where we take our eyes and we make our eyes make so we can see different spectrums.
Right.
Well, now that's changing the limitations of what the eye is supposed to do. You know, simply by placing a chip in my finger so that I can touch something and cause to do something, I haven't really changed the nature of what my finger's supposed to do or the nature of the enhancement of my body. So I don't know if that's necessarily such a bad thing to do that. You know, enhancement is the idea of changing our basic abilities and capacities to function a certain way so that they function in some way superior to what they're supposed to do.
Okay.
That's what I basically mean by that. And that's where I'm just real cautious. Like I said, I'm not definitely saying no, I'm just cautious. I think we need to think that through seriously.
I think that's a good position there.
You know, there's a film, if I can comment, there's a real good film that kind of deals a little bit with this idea of genetic enhancement specifically, because that's where most of the enhancement is taking place. And it's called Gattaca. And in the film, and they present this fairly well, I think, in Gattaca, you know, we're showed this future time when, children, rather than being created through the natural sexual process, okay, children are being basically created in the laboratory. In other words, you know, we in vitro fertilization, and then we genetically, you know, we genetically enhance them, you know, before they're ever implanted in the mother. You know, and so they have, they, so we give birth to these genetically enhanced beings, okay? They're not genetically enhanced in the sense that they're super beings, you know, and it's not something silly like they can fly or, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. But they're superior in the sense that they're just in superior physical condition to other beings. And what that results in, it results in a society where the superior physical beings are the ones that are getting all the good jobs. You know, they're the ones that are being promoted and things like that. And the inferior ones that were the ones that were not genetically enhanced are being treated inferiorly. Well, we've got this with this cross society that's going on here. You know, with that kind of enhancement and such like that, you're going to start treating people differently. You really are. And certain people are going to be treated unfairly than others. It's just bound to happen. And so, I mean, that, those are the kinds of things that concern me down the road with the idea of doing any sort of genetic enhancement.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so let me ask you another kind of cutting-edge medical ethical questions to get your perspective as a Christian and a bioethicist. Is the way, from what I understand, technology is coming along now to where you don't necessarily need a father and a mother to have a child, right?
Right.
You can have, I guess, two mothers or something, and then
I actually have a chart in a book that shows 32 ways to make a baby.
Okay.
And it you know, I used to think there's only one way to make a baby.
Right. Yeah.
You know, not anymore. You know, there are so many, because you can have donors of donors of eggs, you can have donors of sperm, you could place them in a third person who gestationally brings them up, they can be brought up by another person. I mean, there's so many people now that can be involved in it, it truly is amazing what you can do. So, and then the question becomes, who is the baby's parents mm-hmm. at that point? The one who donated the egg, the one who delivered the child, or the one who's bringing up the child? You know, those are three different persons.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you can help us think about this from a Christian perspective. How should we think about this? What should be our ethic with respect to, you know, these fertility treatments and the other kind of thing, or maybe, you know, the other kind of more bizarre sorts of possibilities where maybe two women could have a baby or something
right.
like that. Yeah.
Well, as a Christian and right. especially as a natural law thinker in that particular way, you know, I think that there's a very strong importance concerning the biological bond between parent and child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that that's just accidental. I think it's important that we maintain that as much as we possibly can. Now, I'll make a comment about adoption in a moment, okay? But a biological bond, and I think anytime you introduce a third party into that, okay, you're invading that God-designed biological bond between parents. So in other words, I think the design and the ideal is always a mother and a father who, through normal sexual reproduction, have a child, okay? If the mother and father, for some reason, can't have a child, okay, through normal sexual reproduction, I personally, in principle, don't have a problem if they're seeking some sort of technological means to achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, artificial insemination by the husband, what we call AIH, okay? I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that. That's simply a medical means, therapeutic means, to be able to accomplish something that's naturally can't happen, okay? So sperm is collected from the father and is artificially inseminated into the mother. She conceives, they have a child. No real problems with that, okay? But once you start to introduce a third party, like the father's father doesn't have a high sperm count or doesn't have any sperm count. Okay. So we get a donor father. We get to go to a sperm bank. Okay. And now you've invaded that biological bond at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, if the baby is not related biologically to the father anymore. Now it's related to some stranger out here that donated sperm to a sperm bank.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's problematic. A Christian couple should not use that means to achieve a child because they're denying that biological bond. Okay. I think the use of surrogacy mothers. Okay. Where we basically do a rent-a-womb. You know, the mother and the father, we take her, one of her eggs, we take one of his sperms, we in vitro fertilize it and we place it inside of the surrogate mother. And she gestates the baby. Again, introduces a third person into it. Okay. I think there's more there than just simply an incubator. I think there's a person involved,
mm-hmm.
a mother, who through the process of, you know, developing that child inside of her is in some way or another bonded with that child. Okay. Even though it's not technically her child. Okay. There's no biological relationship, genetic relationship between she and the child, but there's still certainly a bond there because she produced a child inside of her body. You know, so I think we start bringing those third parties in. I think we break up that. When we start to get into things like in vitro fertilization and such, I think there's other problems that come up with that. And for example, in the way that in vitro fertilization is practiced, commonly practiced, is you don't artificially inseminate one egg. You artificially inseminate many eggs. Okay. And then only some of those are actually placed inside the mother with the idea that only one of those will actually, you know, conceive, or one of them, they're actually already conceived, but only one of those will actually attach, okay, successfully attach inside the mother. And so what do we do with all these other ones? Well, we're either cryopreservation, we freeze them, it's used later, or to destroy later, or we destroy them right then and there. Okay. Well, for those of us who believe that life begins, a human person's beginning of conception, which is my view. Okay, that's very problematic, morally problematic to do that to those eggs. And so in general, I'm against the practice of in vitro fertilization as it's commonly practiced. Now, if a person wants to practice it this
maybe
way,
we could just stop. Maybe,
sure,
because I think that was really important. So, what if the life begins at conception? Then in this in vitro fertilization, then there might be hundreds of persons like locked in a
cryopreservation.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And about 80% of babies that are in cryopreservation are ones that are in there designated for implantation sometime down the road. But the problem is that you get a family, for example, that says, well, we're going to preserve our embryos here. We're going to freeze them. So they freeze them. And then they decide down the road not to have those children, which they oftentimes do. Well, what do we do with these ones that are frozen now? Okay. We have to, in some way, they have to be destroyed. Okay. And so most children that are frozen are not implanted. The vast majority of them are either destroyed or they simply, in the process of cryopreservation, isn't a perfect thing. It breaks down the embryo and it gets destroyed in the process of being frozen. Many frozen babies just simply can't be implanted because they've been destroyed through the cryopreservation process itself. Okay, so, I mean, all of that to me is morally very problematic.
Yeah.
Okay, very much so. Now, if you had this situation, let's say, well, I'm going to do in vitro fertilization, but we're only going to do one egg, one sperm, we're going to conceive that, then we're going to place that inside the mother, okay, and you could do that either through GIFT, gamete intrafallopian transfer. Okay, would be probably the best way to do it. Okay, well, we actually do it inside the mother rather than in that. Okay, whatever. I in principle don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is nobody's going to do that because that's extremely financially, you know, not beneficial to anybody. It's very, very expensive. The chances are unlikely that one is going to survive. That's why they do many because, you know, only one out of so many do survive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I mean, nobody wants to do it that way. So the only way to do it efficiently, economically efficiently, is to do these massive things. And that, to me, becomes very problematic. So I think there's problems with in vitro fertilization. I think there's problems with surrogacy parenting. I think there's problems with using any donors involved in artificial reproduction. So I think that some of it can be done, okay? Some artificial insemination can be done. But I think that, you know, we need to just be careful about pushing again beyond the limits of what we're supposed to be doing here.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, there comes a certain point where, you know, couples who want to have children need to seriously ask themselves, why do I want to have this child? You know, and a lot of times it's because, well, you know, I want to have a baby to in some way or another fulfill my need. But that's never supposed to be the biblical view of children. You know, the idea of having children is not to fulfill us. The idea of having children is to be able to produce, in a sense, reproduce God's image in this world to reach this lost world. I mean, it's the child. We do it for the child. We do it for the world. We don't do it for ourselves. And we need to be real careful that we don't take upon ourselves kind of an almost selfish attitude towards having children that drive us to do things that are ethically, morally problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think we need to be careful about that. I have no problem with a couple seeking out, you know, ways to artificially have children. As long as they're careful about what they do and what they're involved with, and they don't end up doing things that are, you know, really morally, if not out and out wrong, at least very much on the edge, you know, that they don't find themselves doing that just to push this issue. So what about adoption? One of the comments I get is, well, if you're so big on this biological bond, you know, should we not be adopting children? Well, no. See, adopting children is different. Adopting children is taking a situation in which there's a tragic situation. Child doesn't have a parent, and trying to jump in and help the child. Remember, it's for the purpose of the child, helping the child that a tragic situation is there. Okay. We're not talking about creating a situation.
Mm-hmm.
See, when we do the in vitro fertilization, when we do the other things, now we're creating the situation. Okay. This is a situation that's already been created. I have no problem with adoption. I think adoption can be the most wonderful thing that can be done. And I think more parents should consider adoption. I think it's a great thing. As long as, again, we understand that even when it comes to adoption, our attitude should be that we're adopting it to help the child. We're not adopting the child to fulfill my need. Okay, we have to be, parents need to be very careful that the purpose of children is not for them in some way or another to be fulfilled. The purpose of children is for the children, okay, in some way or another.
Yeah, I think that's good insight there. I wonder, so one controversial issue in our culture, too, related to this is the life begins at conception.
Right.
So I wonder, and so one thing that will get said a lot too is, well, look, that's a religious perspective, you know, that's not allowed in the debate because it's religious, right? So I wonder, how do you respond to that? Why do you think life begins at conception? How do you bring this into a public discourse, that kind of stuff?
Well, there's a lot here.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can try and put it all together. First of all, we need to talk about the terminology that's involved here, okay? Because you've been using the term life begins conception. Yeah. Well, nobody's going to deny that. Of course, life begins conception, okay? The question is, what is it? What is this thing that's alive, okay? So I make a distinction right at the beginning between the human organism and the human person. Okay. When does a human organism exist, or when does it come into existence? Pick up any biology textbook, though I'll tell you. Moment of conception. Mm-hmm. Okay. When sperm and egg come together, okay, at that particular moment, and if you want to know, it's something like, you know, 1/100th or something like that of a second or something like that. That's the moment we're talking about. When they come together, a new human organism has come about, okay, meaning a whole new DNA sequence has been developed here. You know, 23 chromosomes from the father, 23 chromosomes from the mother. They come together. They form a new 46 chromosome being that's got its own DNA, its own genetic code, its own, you know, mapping. It's an individual organism. That's at the moment of conception. So if you're saying, when does life start? Well, in that sense, right then. So the question really isn't that. The question is, when does the human person start? Does the human person begin at the same moment, or does the human person begin sometime later? Well, that depends upon your definition of personhood. Okay. That's a philosophical issue, by the way. It's not a religious issue. It's not a scientific issue. It's pure 100% philosophy. What does it mean for something to be a person? What exactly is a person? And in general, and I'm being very general here, in general, there's two basic views concerning that. One is called the substance view of personhood, and the other is called the functionalistic definition of personhood. Well, let me do the functionalistic one first. The functionalistic definition of person basically is a person is defined by certain ways that it can function. Okay, so if it has the ability to communicate, if it has the ability to be self-aware, it has the ability to be conscious, these kinds of things, it can function these ways, meaning immediate functioning of these things, okay? Then that's when it becomes a person, okay? That usually occurs between 18 months to 2 years after a child is born. Okay. So really, person and under the functionalistic definition isn't something that occurs anywhere in utero and even after. Okay. Until about 18 months. That's when it begins to be able to have those abilities to do those things. Okay. That's why Peter Singer, with whom I disagree with almost everything, and I do agree about one thing, which is he's right. If the functionalistic definition of personhood is correct, there is nothing wrong with infanticide if there's nothing wrong with abortion. Okay. Because either one of those, you're not killing a person. Okay. You're not harming a person. That's the functionalistic definition. What's the substance view? The substance view basically says this. Everything that exists, every natural kind that exists in the universe, okay, basically has a nature that guides and controls it. That's made up of what we call a basic inherent capacity. Now, by a basic inherent capacity, we simply mean this. First of all, by saying it's basic, it simply means it's a lower capacity as opposed to our higher capacities. We sometimes talk about first-order capacities and second-order capacities. So what's the difference between those? A first-order capacity is the immediate ability to function in a certain way. So you have the capacity, let's say right now, for example, to speak English, okay? You could immediately start talking, okay? That's a first-order capacity. Okay? A second-order capacity is a lower-level capacity that basically is more basic and gives us the ability to perform our first-order capacity. Okay? So I would say a lower-level capacity you have as the kind of being that you are is you have the ability to use reason, to rationalize, ratiocentricity, we call it. Okay? The ability to reason, to think through things. And that's why, while you do not have a first-order capacity to speak Farsi, you have a second-order capacity to speak Farsi. Okay? Now let's compare you to my dog, Toby. Okay, my dog Toby, He doesn't have the first order capacity, Sparky Farsi, just like you. In that sense, you two are the same. But the reason he can't speak Farsi is because he doesn't even have the second order capacity to do so. Whereas you do. You can learn the language, okay? The second order capacities are what we call our basic capacities, okay? And they're inherent because we're born that way, because that's the kind of being that we are. In other words, human beings are supposed to be able to rationally speak, communicate, supposed to be able to function this way, that we can speak and we can speak languages, for example. Mm-hmm. Dogs aren't supposed to. If you couldn't speak a language, we would say that's tragic. If Toby can't speak a language, we don't say that's tragic. Okay. Toby's not supposed to speak a language. So when I look at a mentally retarded person, for example, who has a physical disability that doesn't allow him to be able to express his basic inherent capacities, well, that's sad. That's tragic. He should be able to do this and he can't. Okay. So they're basic and they're inherent. And by a capacity, we simply mean the ability to function a certain way. So when I say you have a basic inherent capacity, I'm simply saying that you have certain capacities that are yours by nature of the kind of being that you are. Okay, that allow you to function certain ways, right? Those capacities are there at present at the moment of conception, okay? Because that's the kind of being that you are at the moment of conception. And all that happens is you just simply develop as that being. You don't develop into that being. Mm-hmm. You develop as that being, okay, develops. Just like any being develops as it develops from the moment of conception. You know, one argument I've heard sometimes is, well, an acorn is on an oak tree. Yes, it is. That's what an oak tree looks like at that level of its development. And as you water it and take care of it and nourish it and maintain it, it will develop as an oak tree. Okay. It won't develop into an oak tree. It develops as an oak tree. In the same way, human persons, because of their basic human capacity, will develop as human persons as long as you maintain them and take care of them. That's why the thing that's conceived doesn't develop as a watermelon. It develops as a person, because that's the way it is. From the watermelon seeds become watermelon. Sunflower seeds become sunflowers. Human seeds become human beings. They don't become that in the sense of they change something different. They develop as that. Okay, that's the basic idea that has that. If you're not going to argue that, okay, then you have to be able to explain where that capacity comes from. In other words, the reason why the functionalistic definition, the reason we function this way, okay, this way. The reason we function this way is because we have a capacity to function this way. It's not the functioning that gives us the capacity. It's the capacity that gives us the ability to function that way. Why do we function this way? Well, because this basic inherent capacity is there. When did it get there? Okay, is it at conception or sometime later? Well, I can't find any time later to put it there. I mean, there are what we call decisive moment theories out there that argue that personhood occurs at different moments. There's like 8 different decisive moment theories when we consider the thing a person. But none of them have anything to do with changing the nature of the kind of thing this thing is. So if you take a substance view of personhood, which basically says that we are substances that develop based upon the nature of the kind of things that we are, okay, that is a different way of explaining personhood, and that could argue strongly for conception for personhood, and it doesn't appeal to any religious argument at all. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's pure. As a matter of fact, what I tell people all the time, the reason I'm pro-life isn't because I'm a Christian, the reason I'm pro-life is because I'm an Aristotelian. Yeah. It's Aristotle, okay, that argues that way. Okay? So that's purely philosophy. Now, we could argue against it. A person wants to argue against the philosophy. That's fine. Right. But the one thing they can't tell me is they can't tell me, well, that's just purely a religious argument. Right. No, it's not. I didn't appeal to any religion on that.
I wonder, too, so with the functionalist view, when you go to sleep, are you still a person?
Well, yeah, that's one of the arguments we sometimes use against functionalists. Okay, otherwise, I'm not functioning that way. I'm not cognitive. I'm not aware, self-aware. I'm not any of that kind of stuff that particular way. You know, well, sometimes I ask the question, why is it that we wake up in the same body we fell asleep in? Well, because there must be something there that's going on that's not functioning, that's there, that's deeper than that. Okay, and that's what I talk about, that basic inherent capacity, that second level of capacity, that's there from the moment you were conceived. Okay, and by the way, the conception is no different than the sleeping person. It's just simply that he's going to wake up later. It's just long. So we can't pick an arbitrary time and say, well, just because he can immediately do it, that makes him a person. And this one who can't immediately do it is not a person. What does time have to do with it? Nothing whatsoever. Matter of fact, sometimes I'll bring out the argument that the only difference between the conceived being and the adult being are 4 things. Size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. Those are the only 4 things, okay? None of them have to do with the nature of the kind of thing that you are, okay? The kind of thing that you are is the kind of thing you are from the beginning, okay? You can't change something's size. It's kind simply by saying, well, it's bigger, or it's not dependent on something anymore, something along those lines.
Yeah, those are all conditional or contingent kinds of properties, no essential properties.
No essential properties, right. What you are by essence is what you are from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a brilliant argument there. I think that a lot of people benefit from that. So we got hit on transhumanism a little bit.
Transhumanism, we talked a little bit about, you know, a bit about maybe euthanasia, abortion. We're hitting on some of the big major bioethical topics here. Physician-assisted suicide is another big thing that's going on. I think you're going to see more and more states going that direction
let's
now.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about, because this is something that people deal with all the time. You know,
right.
Their loved one, I mean, this is something that happened in my family that caused, it was painful because of the issues evolving. But, you know, how are we supposed to think about death and their ability to maybe speak death along when somebody is in pain? How should we think about that as Christians?
Well, it's a good question. Yeah. The two major arguments in favor of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, euthanasia, are what are called the autonomy argument and the mercy argument. The autonomy argument basically says this: it's my life to choose with what I want to do, and therefore, if I want to end my life, I should have the freedom to end my life. And the mercy argument basically says that when the suffering gets difficult enough, you know, people should be allowed to end that suffering. And if the only way to end that suffering is to end life, then that should be one way of allowed to end the suffering. So those are the two major arguments in favor of those kinds of activities. As far as our culture is concerned, they're very strong arguments. Number one, we live in a very strongly autonomous culture where we believe in the freedom of the individual. I mean, our whole country is based on the idea of the freedom of the individual to choose to do with their life. And so we bring that out very strongly. You can't restrict individual freedom without some compelling reason. And usually the only compelling reason that's given is if your freedom is in some way or another encroaching upon somebody else's. Okay. So if it's something I'm just doing for myself and nobody else is being harmed, I should be able to do that. Hence, if I want to end my life and nobody else is being harmed, I should be able to end my life. That's the autonomy argument there. And of course, the mercy argument is very strong because we're a very emotional society. And when we see people suffering, you know, we want to do everything we can to end suffering, which I think is fine. I'm not against ending suffering if we possibly can. But I think we need to be careful that we don't take upon ourselves the idea that anything that ends suffering is a good thing. Okay. We need to realize there's a limit to what we can do to end suffering. Okay. And we can't just do anything in the name of ending suffering. It's not just going to be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, as a Christian, approaching this as a Christian, the autonomy argument is the hardest one to argue against with our culture, okay? Because we do have this view that you should be able to do with your life what you want to. But as a Christian, we need to recognize it's not your life, okay? In other words, we Christians have given our lives over to God, okay? We recognize that God's in charge here, okay? Now, in actuality, I don't believe it's ever only, I don't even believe for the non-Christian, it's just your life. I think God's involved in that as well. He just simply doesn't recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
But we Christians at least recognize it. And so as we Christians recognize, we need to realize the taking of life is not our prerogative, whether it's our own life or any other life. It's just simply not for any reason. It's not our prerogative to do that. Okay. And so I don't think we're allowed to just simply just take life willy-nilly and in an unjustified way. Now, the justified taking of life, like capital punishment, war, those kinds of things, we won't get into those discussions, although they're very interesting discussions. But the taking of any life is just simply not something we should be doing. So therefore, we should not be giving our life over. Okay. And as far as the mercy argument is concerned, again, while I think ending suffering is something we should do, it's not a limitless type thing. We should recognize that we only are allowed to do so much to end suffering. And especially today with managed care type thing situations and with hospice care and some of this stuff, we've been able to do a lot about managing pain management. A lot's been done in that particular area, and a lot more can be done. But here's going to be one of the problems. If we're going to always have suicide as a way out, you know, then that's going to decrease our motivation for trying to find some other ways to manage pain. You know, and in countries where assisted suicide is allowed, like the Netherlands and such like that, you know, hospice care and that kind of stuff is lower because, you know, we don't need it. You know, here's how we handle our end stage pain. We just kill the person. Okay. Well, no, we can end it, most of it. Now, not all pain can be managed. I'm not going to claim that, but a large amount of it has been. You know, so we can manage pain and we can avoid the morally problematic idea of taking over an area that we're not allowed to be handling, which is, you know, whether or not the end of life. We leave that to God. One of the things that bothers me about the assisted suicide movement is that it's incorporated the phrase death with dignity. Okay. And that bothers me because it gives the impression that any other kind of death is undignified. And I disagree with that. I think the person who decides, I'm not going to end my life to end suffering here. I'm going to battle it as best I can. I'm going to live as long as I can. I'm going to fight for life in the name of life. And I'm just going to leave it in the hands of God. I think that's a much more dignified thing to do than the person who says, well, as a way of escaping suffering, I'm going to end my life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see where that's dignified. I think we've brought into the idea that the only thing that's dignified is having control. Okay. And I disagree with that. I don't think people who don't have control are necessarily have less dignity. Okay. We all have to recognize we don't have control over things in our life. Okay. And to sit there and say, well, the only kind of life that has dignity is life, the life where I have complete control of it. I disagree with that kind of thinking there. But I'm bothered by that because what's happened is the assisted suicide advocates, those are in favor of it, have co-opted that phrase, death with dignity, as a way to take something that has in the past always been seen as something that is not good to make it look like now it's noble. Oh, you're doing something noble here. You're having a death with dignity here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But just using a word, just using a phrase doesn't make it noble. Okay. I just don't see where it's any more noble for a person to commit suicide than a person to sit there and say, no, I'm going to continue to live and fight this as best I can and do what I can with it. That's not undignified.
Right.
So anyway, so those are some thoughts on suicide for you.
Well, let me ask you about, what do you think about do not resuscitate?
Well, I think DNR orders are applicable, but DNR orders are a form of passive euthanasia when justified.
Mm-hmm.
They're a form of passive euthanasia. Now, of course, they have to be justified. In other words, a DNR order is not given or is not something that's done lightly. It's something that's done between the doctor and the patient where they basically decide that the patient's reached a certain level now where resuscitation efforts have become more burdensome than helpful. Okay. And where there's very little benefit in continuing on. Okay. That's what happens with the DNR order. Okay. At that particular point then, you know, they may agree that, okay, if the situation has gotten that bad and if I go into some sort of situation where I need resuscitation, I'd rather you not resuscitate me. You know, that's just simply like passive euthanasia.
Right.
That's just simply saying, allow me to die, you know, because further living, further efforts to keep me alive are futile. They're not helpful in any way. There's no benefit. They're extremely burdensome at this particular point. I'm already in the dying process. I'm close to death anyway. At that particular point, DNR orders, I think, are justifiable. And so when they are written with that understanding behind them, I don't think there's a problem with them at all. Okay. It's just simply allowing nature to take its course. You know, you need to remember that a lot of times people are kept alive by machines and things like that simply because we have the technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, those people would have died long ago. It's just simply that we have technology now to keep them alive. Okay. You know, I don't think there's always an imperative to keep every life alive. I think we can reach a point where we can sit there and say, okay, enough is enough. We've done what we can here. We need to allow, I would say God, or maybe the non-Christian would say nature, but we need to allow that to take its course and allow it to run its course there, not feel like we have to do. Again, we need to recognize our limits.
Yeah.
You know, not everything's going to be unlimited.
But so you're drawing a distinction between allowing to someone to die and then causing
right.
them to die.
Yeah, DNRs. Well, DNRs specifically, in our country right now, active euthanasia is illegal in all 50 states. You cannot do any action that hastens death. Okay, so a DNR order is not an action that hastens death. A DNR order is simply an order that simply says if this person goes into some sort of respiratory or cardiac arrest, okay, at that particular point, we will not step in and stop that from happening. We will allow that to continue. Now, it doesn't mean that every time somebody goes into cardiac arrest, it's okay. It just simply means that if we reach a certain situation where a person going into cardiac arrest, resuscitating is not going to benefit that person, and it's extremely burdensome upon that person, you know, and they're already in the dying process, well, then, yes, we're not going to do that. But, for example, you had a heart attack right now sitting here in this room. Well, yeah, of course we're going to do cardiac. It would be to do a DNR order on you now would not be justified. Okay, because you're not in that state.
Right, right.
So DNR orders are only written for people that are in a particular state in which it's justifiable to do that.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. I told you needed to buckle in for Dr. Foreman. He moves quickly. He knows what he's talking about. So I'm sure you benefited from that. Before we go, I just want to direct your attention to the new series we have on moralapologetics.com. It's called Twilight Musings, and it's written by Dr. Elton D. Higgs. Dr. Higgs, he is ending his eighth decade of life on Earth, And he is a mentor for a very long time of our executive editor, Dr. David Baggett. And his post will be going up on every Friday. I encourage you to go read his first two if you haven't got a chance yet. They're just full of insight and wisdom, and I'm sure you'll be encouraged by reading them. And thank you again for listening, and we hope to see you back here again in 2 weeks for our next episode.